Morning. Welcome to Memorial Day Sunday, Pentecost Sunday, and I'm not going to preach about either of those. We live in a world of celebrity, right? Where people, especially given the advent of YouTube, get to make themselves into famous people just because they got a camera and they have access to the internet. And just think about this, how much we think about the world around us and about the people that are in it. And we think in this world of technology, we know a lot of people. Or at least we know what people are known for. And so think about it. You've got somebody like the likes of Neil Armstrong. Neil Armstrong was known for what? Walked on the moon. First man on the moon, right? We know Neil Armstrong. But the question is, do we really know Neil Armstrong? There's certainly much more to Neil Armstrong than the fact that he was the first man to walk on the moon. And so the reality is that we really don't know people that well. But we know people. So think about this. Albert Einstein. Abraham Lincoln. Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Bruce Lee. Alexander the Great. And I saved the best for last, Dusty May. Some of you think that's good. Some of you think that's not so good. Some of you don't know who Dusty May is. That's okay also. But the reality is this. We know people, but it doesn't mean we actually know people. And the reality is this isn't just for celebrities. This is also for people in our lives. You think about your next door neighbor. He's known for blowing his leaves into your yard. That's what you know him for. Or your coworkers, that guy next door that sits next to you that talks too loud. That's what he's known for. Or people at church. There's that bald guy with the long beard who wears shorts and flashy shoes. It's what he's known for. But the reality is that that is not who that person is. There is much more to them than just what they are known for. And my question to us this morning is, how well do we actually know other people? And then the actual more scary version of that question is, how well do other people know me? And this morning, we're going to take a look at a section of scripture where there are two people who were well known in their communities for being certain types of people. And that's where we're going to spend our time. It's Luke chapter 7. We're going to start in verse 36. But before we launch into that, just to set the stage a little bit, we're seeing Jesus in a setting where it's early in his ministry. He's recently launched his ministry. He's called his disciples. They've just started to follow him. And Jesus is starting to draw a crowd. He's going to places, performing miracles, preaching. And there's a lot of people who are coming to listen to Jesus. He's what you might say, he's starting to go viral. People are starting to sit up and take notice, and the people that are following him are really getting into what he's saying. A, he's performing miracles, which is pretty special. I mean, I'll go just watch to see that, but they're starting to believe him. They're starting to listen to him. But then there's also the religious leaders, and particularly the Pharisees are the ones we're going to think about this morning. These religious people who are also seeing that Jesus is drawing these crowds, and they're not so sure who this guy is. They're asking themselves the questions about who is this guy? And what is his theology? Which religious group is he in? Which religious team is he on? Is he on our team or is he on somebody else's team? Whose team is he? And these Pharisees really want to understand who he is. And so again, these Pharisees are people who care about these types of things. So in our modern day, they would be the people who would start, you know, who would put a couple of YouTube videos out, launch a podcast, put some memes out, you know, with Jesus's face, asking the question, you know, is he a heretic? Is he a false teacher? Right? Who is this guy? This is who the Pharisees, as they listen to Jesus, this is the lens that they're thinking about. And so this is shortly after one of these crowd moments. Jesus preaching brought a big crowd in. The Pharisees were there. The people were there. He did some miracles. And shortly after that, a Pharisee came to Jesus and said, "Hey, will you come to dinner?" And Jesus says, "Sure, I'll come to dinner." And that's where we pick it up in Luke chapter 7. But before we do that, I just want to set the stage that understand that this Pharisee lives in Roman era Judea. And important people in that culture had adopted the Roman way of dining. So there were several different ways that they ate. But when you had a special guest, in particular, they had the Roman way of doing it. Which the Roman way of doing it, which I'm not sure I would enjoy this, was you lay on a couch while you eat. Now, I am all about eating on the couch. Ever since I became empty nested, my wife and I find ourselves eating on the couch much more regularly than we used to. But this was their way of feasting. They would recline on a couch and people would come serve them. And it was this big status symbol. I've got a picture here. Actually, I think I have a picture here of here it is. What it looked like for them to recline. This is actually on the top of a sarcophagus. So I'm not really sure why you would do that on the top of your tomb, but this is kind of what it was like. You would sit there, you'd prop yourself up on your elbow, people would come, they'd give you food, you'd feed yourself, and it was this big status symbol to kind of recline while you ate and people came and served you. But then there was this additional power move that they would also do. They would eat out in the courtyard, right on the off the street, and they would leave the door open. So that as people are walking by, they could look through the door and they could see, oh, what's going on in there? And they would see, A, you know, how great the feast was. And B, if you had somebody really important over for dinner, they would see that. And the idea was to kind of show off to the neighbors as a bit of a power move. And the last thing that we should know is this, that in addition to that, you were also welcomed. If the door was open and you were having a meal and you were walking by and you were interested on what was going on in there, you actually were welcome to walk in and just stand there along the side and watch what was going on and hear what was being talked about at the table, especially if there was somebody super interesting there that you had as a guest. So it's kind of a really early version of reality TV, right? So it was, okay, we're going to invite you in and you just watch what's going to happen here. You don't necessarily participate. You just see how these people behave and act. So now we actually will get to the text, starting in verse 36. It says this, "One of the Pharisees asked him," that's Jesus, "to eat with him, and went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with her hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, 'If this man was a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner.'" So here's the setting. So Jesus has come, he's having dinner, he's reclining at the table, he's interacting with the Pharisee, having this conversation, and then in walks this woman with an alabaster jar. And she walks up to Jesus, and as she walks up to Jesus, she's kind of standing behind him at his feet, she begins to cry. And this is not just like she just kind of got a little misty. This is a full body sob. We might call it the ugly cry, right? That whole body, she had lost control of her emotions and the tears were coming from her eyes and they're landing on Jesus' feet, and she then takes her hair and she wipes his feet, and then she takes this ointment and she puts it on his feet and she's kissing his feet, and this is the scene. And then here is one additional note that Luke gives us, which is this, that she was a woman of the city, a sinner. Now, scholars all agree that what this really means is she is a prostitute. She was a known prostitute in that area. Everyone knew who she was. When she walked through that door, everybody said, "Oh, it's the prostitute." And she walks up to Jesus and she creates this scene, right? This Pharisee, he's having his interaction with Jesus, and maybe there's other people who've come in to watch this interaction, and all of a sudden this woman comes in, this prostitute comes in and's creating this scene, and Simon sees it and he thinks, if this man was a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, for she is a sinner, a prostitute. And here we get a bit of a clue maybe why it is that Simon invited Jesus to dinner in the first place. He's curious. Jesus is this curiosity. Nobody can deny that he's doing these miracles, but who is he really? Is he from God? Is he a prophet? Did God send him? And then as Simon sees this, he says, definitely not a prophet. Why? Because if he was a prophet, there is no way he would have let this woman come in and do to him what she just did. No prophet would let him do that, let her do that. And maybe he didn't even know who she was. Maybe he didn't realize she was a prophet, which then just proves the fact that he is no prophet. Because if he was a prophet, he would know. And so here is Simon, who is very clearly saying to himself, I know this woman. She's a prostitute. Jesus did not act with her like I would have acted with her. Therefore, clearly, he's not a prophet. And here's the thing that I want to make sure that we hear loud and clear as we see this. And the point for us to take away is this. We should not evaluate others against our own standard. So this Pharisee looked at this woman, and then he looked at how Jesus interacted with this woman, and he said, If she had came up to me and done that, I would have told her to get away, don't touch me, get out of my house, and then I would have had to go and cleanse myself to be ritually clean. And Jesus did not do that. He did not act rightly. He did not act like I would have acted, and so he clearly is not anybody that of importance. He's no prophet. He was certainly not sent by God. And my question to us is, how often do we fall into this trap? Where we look at how other people act and how other people behave, and we say, well, that's not how I would do it, so clearly they're wrong. I am very guilty of this, and probably the place I am most guilty or have been over the course of my life is in watching how other people parent. How many of us have done this, especially in public places? You walk through, you're like, are you kidding me? Do you see your kid? Because the rest of the store sees your kid. And I certainly wouldn't do that. And because you don't do it like I do it, you're wrong. And we fall into this trap often where we evaluate other people against our own standard, how we would act in a situation, and then we judge them for not acting accordingly. By the way, this is why I teach the Parent of Teens class, so that I can help them know the right way. But we do this far too often, and friends, can we leave room for grace? Can we find, and here's the thing, you guys are going to hear this sermon for 40, 45 minutes here this morning. I've had to sit in this all week. Whereas all week long, as I'm walking around going, are you kidding me? Did you see? Oh, that's right, I'm not supposed to do that. But we do this without even thinking, where we see how other people act and live and behave, and we say, I wouldn't do it like that. And we judge. And we need to leave room for God's grace in this. We need to leave room for people to not be like us, and it be okay. Let's move on. Verse 40. And Jesus answered and said to Simon, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he answered, say it, teacher. And a certain money lender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And he said to him, you've judged rightly. So here, first off, we get the Pharisee's name. The Pharisee's name is Simon, and Jesus refers to him as Simon. We have no reason to believe he's the same Simon anywhere else in Scripture. Simon seems to be a very common name in that time. So it just happens to tell us that his name is Simon. Now, it's interesting that in the verse before, in verse 39, Luke tells us that when Simon saw this woman and how Jesus interacted with her, he said to himself, is what he says. And this should be understood that he didn't just kind of mutter out loud to himself. It's very clear from the Greek that this was an internal dialogue. He said to himself, it was an internal thing, it was in his thoughts. And yet, we see right off in verse 40 that Jesus turns and answers him. Now imagine you're Simon, and you're thinking to yourself, who is this guy? Clearly not a prophet. Why does he act this way? And Jesus turns to you and answers you out loud to the thing you're thinking inside. And all of a sudden you're wondering, oh, huh, no prophet? Maybe, maybe not. So here it is. Jesus is now interacting with his inner thoughts. And he says, Simon, I have something to say to you. And Simon, maybe a little bit freaked out, says, okay, go ahead and tell me. And so Jesus then tells this parable. And a parable really is just a story that's told to illustrate a point or to get across a truth. And so Jesus tells this parable, and he says that there's this money lender, and there's two men that owed him money. One owed him 50 denarii, the other owed 500. Now, a denarii was about a day's wage. So if we think through that, it was about one person owed about 2 months' wage, the other person owed about 2 years' wage. I did the math, and if you believe Google, what the average median income of an American male is, essentially, and of course I don't know if it accounted for inflation or not, or high gas prices, but it translated in today's numbers, it was like one owed $9,200 and the other one owed $92,000. That's essentially, to get it in our common vernacular, how to think about this. And so these two people owed this money lender this money. And what you need to understand in this time, in this day and age, was that if you owed somebody money, that person had a way of getting money out of you. Of which most of them, the person that owed the money, wasn't real fond of. You didn't like those methods. But they had their ways, and they got their money from you. If you owed money, one way or the other, they were getting their money out of you. And so here's the story. These two people owed money. And the money lender brought them in. And he said, okay, you owe $9,200. You owe $92,000. Pay up. And they look at him and say, we can't pay. And the money lender says, oh, really? You can't pay? You can't pay your debt? Okay, I'll forgive it. Go on your way. And Simon would have heard this story, and he would have known, as Jesus is telling this story, that these people owed this money, and they couldn't pay. This is not a good day for them, especially the one that owed 2 years' wage. And then all of a sudden, the money lender forgave the debt. For no other reason than they couldn't pay. No excuse. There was no other extenuating circumstances. Pay. I can't. Well, since you can't pay, I'm just going to forgive it. Go on your way. And then Jesus turns to Simon and he says to Simon, Simon, given this reality, which of these two debtors would love the moneylender most? And Simon, recognizing that Jesus just told this story about him, he sees that he and this woman are both the subjects of this story. A little bit sheepishly knows there's only one right answer, only one logical answer, but he doesn't really want to give it. So he says, well, I suppose it's the one with the bigger debt. But he's not happy about that. He's definitely not happy about the implications of what Jesus is saying. He doesn't love this idea that, first of all, Jesus put him and the prostitute in the same category. How dare you put me in the same category as her? Secondly, he doesn't like the implication of the fact that Jesus is saying, and somebody has forgiven her debt. It's like, do you know who she is? And Jesus now reveals the reality of what Simon was thinking in his head. Because he knows what Simon was thinking. And he is saying, Simon, you think that this woman is a terrible human being who has lived a terrible life. And this is how you see her. This is what she is known for. She is nothing more to you than a prostitute who's lived an awful life. But Jesus says, but then if her debt is forgiven, will she not love more? And Simon, just having seen the way she interacted with Jesus, is starting to put it together that Jesus is saying, she loves me because I have forgiven her. And Simon doesn't like that implication. It doesn't sit well with him as a Pharisee. And so here is Jesus now as he's having this conversation, and he sees this is how Simon is seeing this woman. He's judging her in this very harsh way, even after this woman who came in, who's clearly an emotional wreck, who comes in so full of emotion, this crying, this weeping. There is something in her life, and yet all Simon can do is sit there and judge. And I think then, as Jesus says, all right, Simon, I tell you this story. Simon hears it. What do you think? Simon gives the answer. Jesus said, you have answered correctly. And then he goes on. But now I think Jesus is a little ticked off. In fact, I think Jesus might be a lot of bit ticked off because of how Simon is thinking about this, how he's already got this skeptical approach to this. And so Jesus then comes in. He sees this woman who's clearly wrecked, this total emotional mess. Simon can do nothing other than to judge her because, after all, she is a known prostitute. And Jesus then carries on, verse 44. Then, turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. And so Jesus now reveals, or we hear now from Luke, that there's a detail to this story that up until this point we didn't know was the reality. Simon had not provided the most basic courtesies to Jesus when he came. And that time, the most basic things would have been to provide water for Jesus to wash his feet, would have been to greet him with a kiss, and to provide oil for him in this dry and dusty land. It would be similar to you inviting somebody over for dinner. Say, hey, you want to come for dinner? And they come for dinner. And you don't offer to take their coat. You don't offer them something to drink. And you don't say, and by the way, the bathroom's down the hall to the right. Instead, you walk in, you're like, glad you're here, let's eat. That was kind of what happened. He had not offered any of these things to Jesus. And the most basic of basics would have been to provide water for Jesus to wash his feet. See, if you invited somebody over for dinner, they would have taken a bath before they showed up. It was kind of a stinky, you know, place to live. Not a lot of personal hygiene going on there, but the Romans highly prized personal hygiene. And so when Jesus was invited for dinner, Jesus would have taken a bath, and then he would have walked to Simon's house for dinner. And in the process of walking, his feet would have gotten dirty. He would have showed up, the rest was clean, but he would have needed to wash his feet. And it was expected that Simon would have at least provided that water for Jesus to wash his feet, but he'd failed to do so. And so this is the scene then that the woman came into. She walks in, and Luke records no words spoken, but there is a deep level of intention from this woman. It says that she heard that Jesus was dining at this particular house. And when she heard that he was there, she went and got her alabaster flask of ointment, and she took it and went to the house. And she entered the house, and we now know that she entered as a prostitute. And all eyes would have been on her. She walked through the door, and you can imagine the conversations going. This person walks through the door, and everybody would have turned. It's a Pharisee's house. Everybody knows how the Pharisees think about prostitutes, and all eyes would have been on this woman. There is a level of intentionality here that on her part that was more than just a passerby who was like, oh, hey, interesting people, I'm going to go in. She had to go get the alabaster flask before she came, And she walked in, and now everybody's looking at her. And she sees Jesus, and she walks over to Jesus. And I don't think she came intending to cry. I don't think she walked in here with the intention of, I'm going to walk in and lose it emotionally in front of this whole group of people. Like, nobody does that. I think for her, she came in, and I think this is where we're starting to realize that this is not the first time this woman has met Jesus. This woman has met Jesus before. And she intentionally says, Jesus is there. I'm going to go there to see Jesus. And she brings this alabaster flask of expensive ointment. And did she intend to give it to him as a gift? We don't know. Did she intend to actually put it on him? We don't know. But she came with the flask to see Jesus. But it's clear she came not as a sinner seeking penance. She came as a sinner who had already received forgiveness. Because she walked through that door, everybody's looking at her, she sees Jesus, she goes to Jesus, this one who has forgiven her. This one who clearly she's recognized who he is, that he is the Messiah. And he who has been forgiven much loves much. And here she is at Jesus' feet. Maybe she's kneeling over his feet. Maybe she's standing over his feet. And as she looks at Jesus and everybody sees her as the prostitute, she knows Jesus sees her as her. He sees her not as the prostitute. And she loses it. And she begins to weep. That full body loss of control of your emotions. And she begins to weep. And the tears begin to fall from her eyes. They fall onto Jesus' feet. And that's when she realizes Jesus' feet are not washed. She's making a muddy mess of Jesus' feet. You know, when something's dirty, you just see, oh, you know, that's a little dirty. You add a little water, and you're like, wow, that is really dirty. Here she is at Jesus' feet, and she looks down, and her tears are covering his feet, and it's a muddy mess. And she's going, what do I do? And all she's got is her hair. And she wipes off the muddy mess off Jesus' feet with her hair. And she's got this alabaster flask, and she applies the ointment to his feet. And out of gratitude, out of deep gratitude, she can't stop herself from just kissing his feet. Because of the deep gratitude, one who loves much, who has been forgiven much, loves much. So here she is. She's this known prostitute. And we in this reality then that this reality that everybody saw her as that. And this is where Jesus then, where I say, I think Jesus was a little bit ticked off, or a lot of bit ticked off. Because now he says to Simon, Simon, you didn't give me water to wash my feet. This woman has wet my feet with her tears, and she wiped them with her hair. Simon, you didn't greet me with a kiss. That's the greeting you would have given the next door neighbor when he walked in to ask about the weather. She hasn't stopped kissing my feet. You didn't give me oil for my face, this dry land where our skin is so dried out, and yet you gave me nothing. Yet she you gave me no oil, but she put expensive ointment on my feet. It's interesting that in this part it says that he turned to the woman, and yet he addressed Simon. And so here he is, he's turned the woman, and he's speaking to Simon in this, and he says these things to her, and then he calls this out. He says, Simon, do you see her? And I think the implication of this isn't, do you see her? Like, did you see that she's here? Because everybody would have seen her. She's the known prostitute. All eyes were on her. The question isn't, you know, did your eyes see it and your occipital lobe in your brain register, there's a person here? The question is this, Simon, do you see her? Or do you just see a prostitute? Do you see a person here? Somebody with a name. Somebody with a family. Somebody with a past. Somebody who's more than just what they are known for. This image bearer of God. Do you see her? And of course, we know he doesn't. All he sees is the prostitute. And Jesus calls him out. And he compares Simon to the woman, saying, she did all these things for me, and you did none of them. And he clarifies it all for Simon, and he interprets the parable with her life and contrasts it with his, and says, do you see this woman? She acted in a way that clearly shows that her sins are forgiven. And because her sins are forgiven, she loves much. Do you see her? She's been forgiven much. She loves much. But not you, Simon. Simon, you are cold and you are dead. You think you have nothing to be forgiven for. Therefore, you love little God and man. Because you think you have nothing to be forgiven for, your love is affected by that. Now, let's be clear. This does not mean those who have sinned less will be less grateful for the fact that their sins have been forgiven. That's not what Jesus is saying here. He's pointing out Simon's unbelief. He says, you are so stinking self-righteous that you don't think you have anything to be forgiven for. And because of that, you are unable to really love. You cannot see her for something other than being a prostitute. As one author put it, commenting on this passage, it is easier to give up sin than to give up self-righteousness. It is easier for the prostitute to say, I am going to change my life. My entire life up to this point is going to change. I will do something different. It is easier to give up our sin than our self-righteousness. Simon couldn't do it. Jesus, speaking to the religious leaders in Matthew chapter 21, said, because of your unbelief and your inability to see the real condition of your own hearts, he says, truly I say to you, the tax collectors and prostitutes go into the kingdom of heaven before you. Self-righteousness is harder to give up than our sin. When we think we're okay and we have nothing to be forgiven for. So here's the big point of the morning. If you get nothing else, get this. We can only love and be loved to the degree that we're known. This woman was fully known. Everybody knew who she was. She knew who she was, what she owed. She knew she needed forgiveness. And she encountered the God of the universe in Jesus. She was fully known to him. And because of that, was able to experience forgiveness. And once she received that forgiveness, being fully known in all of her sin, this woman was a known prostitute. And she was fully known to the entire community. And when we are fully known to God and experience his forgiveness, there is a love there that is like none other. But until we are known, until we admit who we are, until we recognize the depth of our own depravity, it's impossible to be forgiven. Many of us, even Christians, fall into one of two ditches. We talk a lot about ditches around here. And the first ditch is this, that sin is no big deal. That we look at our life and we think, oh, our sin is really not that big a deal. This was the ditch that Simon fell into. He said, I really don't need to be forgiven. Sure, nobody's perfect, right? We've all said that. You know, who's perfect? Nobody's perfect. So I suppose there's occasions where I may need to be forgiven. But in the end, I've really got a handle on my own sin. I'm pretty good. You don't recognize who we are as sinners, as debtors. And when we fail to see who we really are, to be a known sinner, it affects how we love. And in fact, it usually leads into us judging other people that we deem to be less righteous than us. We look down at people. Instead of recognizing the depth of our own sin, we look down on other people and say, wow, they're really bad. And we judge them. The ditch on the other side is that we allow our sin to define us. We allow our sin to define me. On the one side, it's my sin's not a big deal. The other side, my sin is such a big deal that how could I possibly be forgiven for it? Maybe I've been forgiven to a degree. Maybe if you're here and you've trusted Jesus as your Savior, you say, well, I'm forgiven enough for my salvation. But my sin is still who I am. My sin still defines who I am. And when we do that, when I allow my sin to continue to define me, I cannot experience the depth of forgiveness that God wants to give me. And when I don't experience the depth of the full forgiveness, when Jesus died, he died for all my sins. All of them. When you think of your life and you think about those sins in your life that you wish did not exist, when you think about past things you've done, behaviors you've chosen, and you think, how could I ever be forgiven for that? That is who I am. That is all who I will ever be. That is what I am known for. When that is your reality, when you live in that ditch and you don't experience the full forgiveness of your sin, it affects how you love. It affects how you love God and how you love others. These are the ditches. But this woman experienced true life. Our mission statement here at Calvary is that we develop followers of Jesus for life. There's a double meaning to life. It's we follow him all of our life, but in the process of following him, we receive life. And this woman experienced true life. She was fully known by God and man. She could not pay her debt, no matter how great it was. She could not pay it. And yet she is fully and completely forgiven. And because of that, she was able to love much. This woman was fully known. She had nowhere to hide. Simon, let's just be clear, he owed as much as the woman. He owed as much as her, and yet he was able to hide in plain sight. He could hide behind his religion and how he behaved and how he lived his life. He hid in plain sight. But the version of him was the one that he painted for everybody else to see. It wasn't the real version of who he was. So it has been said that the greatest day of our lives is the day that we face ourselves. It's the day that we stop hiding. It's the day that we stop hiding behind our behavior. The day we say, this is who I really am. And I face myself. Because it isn't until we are able to face ourselves that we're able to recognize the me that really is. The one that is a debtor that cannot pay his own way. Who I owe so much that I could not possibly begin to pay that. And when we finally face ourselves and realize that is who I am, we're finally open to the forgiveness of the God of the universe. And those who are forgiven much, love much. But until we face ourselves, we'll continue to hide, just like Simon did. Simon continued to hide behind his own self-righteousness. He continued to hide behind the fact that he was this religious guy who had it all together. So let me come back to the question that we started with. What are you known for? The real you. What are you known for? This woman was known for being a prostitute. Simon was known for being this religious guy. The parable clearly puts the woman and Simon in the same category. They both had the same identity. They both were people who were in debt and they could not pay. They couldn't get out of their debt. My question to you this morning is, where is your identity? And the Bible's clear, there's only two identities. And the first is that of debtor. It doesn't matter how sinful you are or how religious you are, Everybody starts off in this identity. This is who you are. Your identity is that of debtor. You cannot pay what you owe. But that doesn't need to be your identity. When Jesus said to Simon, "Simon, do you see her? Do you see this woman?" He clearly indicates that debtor is no longer her identity. She has a new identity. Her identity has changed. She is no longer debtor. She no longer owes. Her new identity is that of dearly loved child of the Most High God. There is only two identities, debtor and dearly loved child of the Most High God. My question to you this morning is, where is your identity? Are you debtor? Or are you a dearly loved child of the Most High God? Because those are your only two choices. And if the woman was with us today, if she were here this morning and she could talk to us, she would tell us the difference between these two identities, debtor and dearly loved child of the Most High God, the difference between those is Jesus. Jesus is the only difference between those two. She met Jesus and it changed her life for all of eternity. She was no longer known as a prostitute. Jesus saw her. He knew her. He knew her entire life, and yet he loved her. He forgave her. She was now known as one who she loved, and she's known as the one who Jesus loved with her entire life, with his entire life. She showed her love for Jesus with her tears and with her ointment and with her kisses. And Jesus showed his love to her by hanging on a cross. Jesus said of himself, "Greater love has no one than this, that they lay down their life for their friends." This is how Jesus showed his love to this woman. She showed her love to him and how she poured out her gratitude at this meal. Jesus showed his love for her by dying on the cross. Finally, we'll end with this. Verse 48. "And he said to her, 'Your sins are forgiven.' Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, 'Who is this who even forgives sins?' And he said to the woman, 'Your faith has saved you. Go in peace.'" So after all of this, right? After all this interaction starts off, he's interacting with everybody around the table. The woman comes in. He has this interaction with her. And then he has this very direct dialogue with Simon. Finally, here at the end, he turns his attention fully to the woman, completely to her, and he affirms her. Imagine, here she is, on her knees, crying mess, snot, tears, mud in her hair, right? This is the scene. And Jesus has been talking about her, and how much she's tuning into this, we don't know. This interaction with Simon, we don't know. But she is this mess. And Jesus looks at her and says, "Sweetheart, your sins are forgiven." He says, "Your faith has saved you. You're good." You're good. Your sins are forgiven. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Quite literally, this the Greek reads, "Go into peace." The idea here isn't just go in this way of peace. What Jesus is saying is you go from this place into your new reality. Your new reality is a reality of peace, not of all of the crazy that your life has been defined by up to this point. Go into this world, go into peace. And quickly, for the sake of time, because we don't have time to go into it any deeper, is we have the reaction of the guests, where they're like, "Who in the world is this guy? Thinks he can forgive sins." Notice Jesus' response. "There is none." He's like, "I'm not even going to respond to that." He ignores them, and he puts his focus simply on the woman. And Jesus says, and the idea is, this was just between him and her. They're talking, "Who is this guy?" And this is him looking at her, and he's known to her, and he's known to him, and that's all that mattered. It didn't matter what anybody else was saying.